Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, May 20th, 2006. Today, we will be focusing on Palestine, plus bringing you the words of children about war and peace. Here's what we have coming up. In our first hour, Newmarket Elementary School children tell us what they think peace is, followed by a Making Waves interview of Ann Miller from New Hampshire Peace Action about her recent trip to Palestine and Israel. We then have a reading from Three Wishes, Palestinian and Israeli Children Speak. Our second hour starts with a report from the West Bank Palestine on the history and current struggle of the village of Bilin. And then Jav Parrish brings us commentary entitled, Now We Care? We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news and analysis.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. Turkish-Iranian armies build up forces along Iraq's only quiet area, from the Canadian Press and the AP, reported on May 13th. Hundreds of Kurds had to flee their homes in the mountain village of Razka, Iraq, when artillery shells came whistling down from Iran early this month, blowing apart their homes and livestock. In Turkey, meanwhile, armored personnel carriers and tanks rumble along its remote border with Iraq's Kurdish zone. Turkey has sent tens of thousands of fresh soldiers in the last few weeks to beef up an already formidable force there. The Kurdish provinces of northern Iraq are the country's most stable and prosperous area, but to neighboring Iran and Turkey, they are something else, an inspiration and a support base for the large Kurdish minorities in their own countries. So Iran and Turkey are sending troops, tanks, and artillery to the frontier to seal off the borders and send a message. If the U.S.-backed Iraqi government doesn't clamp down on Kurdish guerrillas who use Iraq as a base, they'll do it themselves. That has left the United States in a quandary. If U.S. forces take action, they risk alienating Iraqi Kurds, the most pro-American group in the region. And if they don't, they risk increased tensions, and possibly worse, with two powerful rivals. Turkish Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül said, "We would not hesitate to take every kind of measures when our security is at stake." He had been asked whether Turkish troops might cross into Iraq. He added, "The United States best understands Turkey's position. Everybody knows what they can do when they feel their security is threatened." Tehran may also be flexing its muscles to remind the United States that it shares a long border with Iraq and could cause serious problems there for the United States. The traditional Kurdish region spans Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria, and the guerrillas are based in a mountain range of northern Iraq that stretches into Turkey and Iran. They seem determined to keep up their decades-long struggle. Kurdish guerrillas of the Party of Free Life of Kurdistan, or PJAK, have called on Kurds in western Iran to begin a campaign of civil disobedience. In clashes with Iranian security forces last year, dozens of PJAK fighters and about a dozen Iranian soldiers were killed, according to official Iranian reports. This year, more than a dozen members of Turkish security forces in southern Turkey have been killed fighting Kurdish guerrillas of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is closely allied with PJAK. And from CNN and the AP, Gitmo inmates attack guards stopping a suicide. Prisoners wielding fans, light fixtures, and other improvised weapons clashed with guards trying to stop a detainee from committing suicide at the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the military said. The clash happened in a medium security section of the camp as guards were responding to the fourth attempted suicide of the day at the detention center on the U.S. Navy base, Commander Robert Durand said. Detainees struck guards as they entered a communal living area to stop a prisoner who was trying to hang himself, Durand said. Earlier in the day, three detainees in another part of the prison attempted suicide by swallowing prescription medicine they had been hoarding. Detainees involved in the fight with guards were moved to higher security sections of the detention center. Those who attempted suicide received medical treatment, the military said. Their names were not released. On Thursday, the U.S. military transferred 15 Saudi detainees to the custody of their country, leaving about 460 detainees at Guantanamo. There have been 39 suicide attempts at Guantanamo since the detention center opened in January 2002, the military said. The UN Committee Against Torture called on the United States to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay and end questionable interrogation techniques and close any secret prisons. The United States has defended the use of the Guantanamo facility to hold so-called enemy combatants without charges for as long as the war on terror may last, saying that the detainees are suspected of links to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. But detention without charges runs counter to established human rights law, and the war on terror does not constitute an armed conflict under international law, this report and past UN reports have concluded. And from the British Independent, Iraq's ragtag army units start fighting among themselves. Published May 14th. A gun battle between two units of the Iraqi army has left one soldier and a civilian dead, underlining how ethnic and sectarian divisions are crippling the U.S.-trained force. The shooting, which took place between Kurdish and Shia soldiers north of Baghdad, is a bad omen for U.S. plans to hand over security to the Iraqi army by the end of the year. The fighting started after a powerful roadside bomb exploded as an Iraqi army convoy carrying Kurdish troops passed. Immediately after the attack, the Kurdish soldiers rushed their wounded to the local hospital, firing their weapons to clear the streets and killing one civilian. At this point, going by the police account, another unit of the Iraqi army, the 3rd Battalion of the 1st Brigade, this time consisting of Shia troops, rushed to confront the Kurds. They appeared to have thought that the Kurds were going to retaliate against the local Arab population. Shots were exchanged, and one Shia soldier was killed. The Kurds decided to remove their wounded from that hospital, fearing it would not be safe for them to be left there. But as they tried to leave the town, a third unit of the Iraqi army set up a roadblock, preventing them from escaping. At this point, U.S. troops, who have a giant military base at Balad nearby, intervened and succeeded in ending the confrontation. The incident shows the deepening divisions and mistrust within the Iraqi army. Washington has repeatedly claimed that its aim is to train Iraqi security forces loyal to the central government and capable of fighting the armed resistance to the occupation. But the Iraqi army has remained a ragtag force. In 2004 to 2005, its entire $1.3 billion procurement budget was stolen or spent in return for outdated or non-functioning weapons. Its vehicles, often elderly pickup trucks, are very vulnerable to roadside bombs such as the one which hit the convoy of Kurdish soldiers on Friday. Even the numbers of the army are unclear because it contains many ghost soldiers whose salaries are still being drawn by their commanders. And from the Associated Press, U.S. proposes new disarmament treaty. The United States proposed a treaty Thursday it said would curb proliferation of nuclear weapons and improve the world's leverage against so-called hard cases like Iran and North Korea by banning production of weapons-grade uranium and plutonium. Stephen G. Rademacher, acting U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, told the 65-nation conference on disarmament that it should aim to approve a treaty by September. He said current measures to prevent terrorists and governments from developing weapons of mass destruction may be insufficient. The proposal contains no verification measures, and stockpiles of fissile material would not be affected, allowing existing nuclear powers to build weapons with their reserves. And with Iran and North Korea accused by Washington of flouting current international accords on nuclear weapons development, Rademacher did not specify how the United States thought the new agreement would help. In Washington, Wade Boyce, research director at the Private Arms Control Association, said, "The value of the agreement would be getting India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea, and potentially Iran to sign on to this agreement, but the likelihood is very small. One reason," he said, "is the lack of verification measures, which most countries at the conference want in any treaty. The stripped-down U.S. proposal, only 3.5 pages long, leaves out verification measures to avoid years of protracted negotiations and get the treaty passed faster. The proposal says governments could use national means or intelligence to detect violations by other countries and report them to all treaty members or to the Security Council. The U.S. proposal would go into force with the approval of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council, Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States. Other nations said they welcomed the U.S. initiative, but indicated differences with the approach. Both China and Russia said progress on fissile materials should not come at the expense of other treaty proposals. The two countries have proposed a treaty to ban weapons in outer space, which is clearly aimed at the United States' anti-missile program." Johan Kellerman of the South African delegation said that to be truly credible, the treaty should curb existing stockpiles. He added, "A complete halt of the production of fissile material would nevertheless leave enough of the material available to further increase and not decrease the number of nuclear weapons." And from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Iraq, Rumsfeld again accuses Iran of interference. From May 17th, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has reiterated that he believes Iran is contributing to the instability in Iraq, telling U.S. senators that a hasty withdrawal from Iraq would merely serve Iran's interests. Rumsfeld told members of the Defense Subcommittee of the Senate Appropriations Committee on May 17th that U.S. forces continue to find Iranian-manufactured weapons in Iraq, though he conceded that there was no conclusive proof of Iranian involvement. Rumsfeld argued, "If people are anxious to see Iran successful in the path they're on, it strikes me that tossing in the towel on Iraq would be a boost for Iran." He also appeared to suggest that a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq would encourage Iran in its confrontation over its nuclear program. The public pressure that Washington is under to cut the number of U.S. troops in Iraq was evident in the committee room when guards hauled off an anti-war protester after she shouted "liar" at Rumsfeld. General Peter Pace, who gave testimony along with Rumsfeld in his capacity as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, indicated that the process of transferring responsibility to Iraqi forces is accelerating. But Rumsfeld said he could make no promise of significant withdrawals. And as it turns out, a newly breaking ABC News story reports that 1,300 new U.S. soldiers are on their way to Iraq. That was the news you need to know. And now here's the context of that news that you should probably know too. That story by Radio Free Europe is essentially news produced by the CIA. And according to How the CIA Created Osama Bin Laden by Norm Dixon, between 1978 and 1992, the U.S. government poured at least $6 billion worth of arms, training, and funds to prop up the Afghan Mujahideen factions against the USSR. Saudi Arabia and Osama bin Laden provided millions more. Washington's policy in Afghanistan was shaped by Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. His plan went far beyond simply forcing Soviet troops to withdraw. Rather, it aimed to foster an international movement to spread Islamic fanaticism into the Muslim Central Asian Soviet republics to destabilize the Soviet Union. U.S.-run Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe beamed Islamic fundamentalist tirades across Central Asia. Washington's favored Mujahideen faction was one of the most extreme, led by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was notorious for throwing acid in the faces of women who refused to wear the veil. It seems to me that only the CIA could be brazen enough to help Rumsfeld accuse Iran of interfering in Iraq. Can reporters not see all the U.S. weapons in Iraq, much less the 130,000 troops? Of course, we're not interfering there. We're just engaging in a brutal military occupation and dictating the policies of the Iraqi government. The CIA sees no logical flaw in continuing the occupation of Iraq to prevent Iran from developing their nuclear technology. I would suggest they send messages with diplomats, not with warriors. The earlier story I read about the new disarmament treaty the U.S. is pushing also failed to mention how it is probably an attempt to continue trampling on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the U.N. General Assembly in general. The U.S. hopes for a future where it can control U.N. policy through the Security Council, using only U.S. evidence free from the inconvenient contradictions of investigators like the IAEA. It also declares that the U.S. can continue developing lots more nuclear weapons, despite our clear promises in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to implement total disarmament.
On May 11, 2006, Seacoast Peace Response presented at the Newmarket, New Hampshire Elementary School Career Day about peace and justice work. The kids, all between 6 and 8 years old, were invited to state for Making Waves their ideas of what peace is. They also made peace flags, which some of them will be describing for you.
What does peace mean to you? This could go out to a lot of people. If you want to just say something about peace in general, that's great. You can also explain into the microphone about your flag you made.
I think peace is when you're having trouble to do something and then someone comes over to you and decides to be really, really good friends and kind of like help you to get along.
I think peace is something that you like.
I think peace is that you have to take a break once you take a lot of time for your child and you get kind of angry.
I think peace is the opposite of war.
I think peace is great.
I think peace is when you try to stop the war.
I think peace is that it's love and it's very take care of, and I really like it. And I think peace is very thoughtful.
peace means to me, it's fair to everybody. Like, they get the same, like, amount of things, like, the same amount of food every day.
My flag has two fingers, and that means peace, and it has some hearts, and it says peace on both fingers, and it says peace, peace, peace.
I think peace is everything you could say good built in together.
Peace is thoughtful, and peace is about love, and it's about to take care of people.
My flag is showing the sign of peace on Earth.
I think peace is all about taking your time and caring for others.
I think peace is a good thing to stop war.
I read the news today, oh boy, just about a bunch of poor men with doors to learn and how to lead the hard way. The more things change, they stay the same. So Jesus walked the earth still playing the same game. Everybody's waiting to move on. But I know in my heart, all we got to do is stop and know the world is possible. I'm gonna walk around, I wanna make a joyful sound, cause another world is possible. Some folks like to scream and shout, raise the fist in the air about everything they think is going wrong. But me, I think we'd get more done if we joined our hearts as one. Spread a dream and sing along. And I know in my heart, all we got to do is start. And another world is possible. Yeah, I'm gonna walk around, I wanna make a joyful sound, cause another world is possible.
That was Stephen Smith with Another World is Possible. And now, Ann Miller of New Hampshire Peace Action speaks with us about her recent trip to Palestine and Israel.
This is Steve Diamond with Making Waves. I'm here with Ann Miller, director of New Hampshire Peace Action, who just spent 2 weeks in Palestine and Israel. When did you get back exactly?
I got back on April 6th.
What did you see on your trip there? And were you prepared for it?
Oh, we saw so many things and met so many amazing people. We were centered in Jerusalem, and we actually stayed in East Jerusalem, which is the Arab portion of Jerusalem, and made that our home base. And from there, we went to Ramallah, Birzeit, and then down to Hebron and Bethlehem, and then a refugee camp just to the southwest of Bethlehem, and several other smaller towns. And then in Greater Israel, we visited the town of Lid, and then Tel Aviv, and then we were obviously all over Jerusalem as well.
Last time I interviewed you a few months ago, before you left, you said that it's a small place. You'll probably be able to go to a lot of places. Were the checkpoints more of a issue than you thought they would be?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, Steve. And one of the most interesting things, I think, about Israel and Palestine is that despite the fact it's tiny, both territories are tiny, somehow with the checkpoints and with the roadblocks and with the wall, it's made to seem enormous. For instance, it's only about 45 miles from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, but it takes hours and hours, I mean, the better part of half a day, through the checkpoints and the nature of the roads. And it's just so fascinating, where in Jerusalem we were really only about 35, 40 miles from Gaza, but it might as well have been as far as we are in Concord or Portsmouth from Baghdad. Somehow the geography of the occupation really separates things in such a way that many folks in Tel Aviv don't even know what's happening in Gaza or in the West Bank. It's really quite striking.
Tell us some of your stories that really stick in your mind of situations that were surprising to you or that might be illustrative of some of the issues of the region.
Sure. I think one of the most interesting visits that we had was with students at Birzeit University. Birzeit University is just north of Ramallah, just about 20 miles from Jerusalem proper. And many of the students there are about 7,000 Palestinian students who attend Birzeit University. And many of the students there have actually never even left their hometown of Ramallah or Birzeit, again, because students who are living there can't get visas or access to Jerusalem or to Israel or to Jordan. And so you have this sense that people really don't leave place, which I think is very unlike what we see in this country and many parts of the West. And one of the most sort of interesting stories we heard was there used to be a checkpoint between the towns of Ramallah and Birzeit, where the university is, and so students would have to walk the better part of a mile in order to get to campus to study every day. And there were random closures of the different checkpoints. And one day in protest, because they couldn't get through, they went ahead and just held their classes there at the checkpoint itself. And I found that a very powerful form of nonviolence. Another really interesting thing about Birzeit University is that every year they elect their government, their student government, and their student government is sort of a miniature of what you see in the larger politics of Palestine, where you have the different parties like Fatah and Hamas. And interestingly, the national leaders look to those elections to see who wins, because evidently they are a very good barometer of what's happening in Greater Palestine. And every year after the elections happen of the members, a good number of them get arrested by the Israeli Defense Forces. And so running for office for Birzeit University students is a form of nonviolent civil disobedience in a way, because they're guaranteed to be some arrests based on the election outcomes. And I just thought that the willingness of students to do that was really quite remarkable. That said, I would also say that being jailed, if you're a Palestinian, especially a Palestinian man, is not remarkable. Every Palestinian man we spoke to had been jailed at one time or another by the Israeli Defense Forces. It's really quite incredible.
What's the premise that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, use to make those arrests? Are they claiming that these people are members of a so-called terrorist organization?
It can really be anything. They don't even need to make any. There doesn't need to be a premise. It can be aiding and abetting terrorists, or being a terrorist, or having families who are members of terrorist groups or suspected of some sort of untoward activity. It can be anything.
I've also recently heard that travel restrictions in the area are not just limited to the Palestinians, that even Israeli citizens, civilians, are not allowed to go to the occupied territories. Is that a recent development, and what impact does that have on the dynamics there?
Yeah, it is true, and I think this is another heartbreaking aspect of the occupation, is that although Palestinians can't visit Israel, Israelis also can't visit Palestine. It was very interesting. We were in West Jerusalem at a Women in Black vigil. The Women in Black women and men protest every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. in the center of Jerusalem. They protest the occupation. And while we were there with them, a woman came up, an Israeli woman, a Jewish Israeli woman, and said, you know, why are you out here? Why are you doing this? Because my children aren't safe to go to the mall under the threat of a terrorist attack. And we tried to explain that we were here exploring both sides of the story, because that's what our delegation was directed to do. And when we mentioned we had been in Ramallah, she said she wouldn't believe it at first. And then she said that, well, the Israeli Defense Forces must have been following you and taking care of you. And that wasn't the case at all. And in fact, we did have a Jewish woman on our delegation. She was actually one of the leaders of our delegation who was with us in Ramallah that day. And the woman who came up to us, she just couldn't believe it, and her consternation was honest. I don't question that at all. It was just a matter of the fact that she had no experience of Ramallah, and so couldn't relate to anybody having been there. And then if you can't relate to place, and you can't relate to people, you have these deepening divisions that are happening, and this polarization is happening at a greater and greater rate, especially since the wall began in 2003. And I'd say even before that, following the Second Intifada in 2000 is when things really began. And so we met with students at Brzezet University. They had no Jewish friends. We met with students from Hebron University in Jerusalem, who were a Jewish university. They have no Palestinian friends. And when you don't know one another, how can you find peace and justice with one another?
And that's a fairly recent development, isn't it, as far as that kind of schism culturally? I know I've worked at camps, for instance, where they particularly make an effort to bring Israeli Jews and Palestinians together to build friendships.
Yeah, Seeds of Peace is one of the most important organizations doing that, both here, I believe they have a program in Maine, and then also in Israel and in the West Bank. And I can think of no better program and no more crucial civil society program than Seeds of Peace at this point.
I wonder if the cultural separation in Israel and Palestine is sort of undermining fatally that strategy for bringing about peace in the region. Is that a realistic approach still? How can that help?
Sure. I think it's more than just a cultural separation. It's a physical separation as well. And I think it's important to remember that. I think there is still a great deal that civil society can do. And I don't think we should be discounting that. I think what we hear in the press, whether it be by Hamas or be by Kadima, I don't think that reflects either of those parties and the voices that are speaking as representatives of those parties really reflects what people think. One of the most striking things that I learned in visiting with Palestinians is that nobody doubts the continued and continuing existence of Israel. And not one Palestinian I spoke with had anything to say about the destruction of Israel or somehow Israel no longer existing. I think that most Palestinians, and every Palestinian I spoke to, simply wants the 22% that's constituted by the West Bank and by Gaza. And at this point, they don't even have that. The way things are working now with settler-only access roads and with the settlements themselves is basically what's happening is that the West Bank has been divided into three cantons. And so if you're in the north in a town like Nablus, you can't get to Jericho or Hebron. And there's no economic viability between the three cantons or from Palestine to the rest of the Middle East. They're almost exclusively dependent on Israel for their economic viability. And with the wall going up, fewer and fewer Palestinians are able to work in Israel and get the necessary credentials to work in Israel. And ironically, Israel is actually importing guest workers from other countries. including Asia. And so you've got Palestinians who are really left, in some cases literally, if you look at the West Bank, to starve at this point.
Well, you brought up a lot of points, so I wanted to touch on more. Let's start with that one, though. I did see a report that some of the bakeries in Palestine were running low on flour and on the verge of closing down. What's the story on that?
Yeah, those reports were coming from Gaza, and the UN did declare that there was a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And I did not visit Gaza. It was too dangerous for Westerners to visit while we were in the area. We did talk, actually, with two journalists who were staying at our hotel, and they just said the situation was just it was in such crisis. There's only one access to or from Gaza at this point. The checkpoint at Rafah on the Egyptian border is closed, and anybody who says that Israel has disengaged from Gaza is just not speaking the truth. There's still total control. It's basically a detention center. There's still shelling happening in northern Gaza Strip. There's no light. I know that none of the lights were working when these two journalists were there in Gaza City, and that creates crisis. There's limited electricity, limited water, limited food. There's chaos. Civil society is just breaking down. And last October, when the 7,000 settlers left, everybody, or I should say the media, and I remember picking up a People magazine and seeing the horrified faces of the Israeli Jews as they were being pulled, kicking and screaming out of Gaza Strip. During that same time period, 12,000 Israelis were moved into settlements in the West Bank. And so basically there was a net gain in the settlement territory of 5,000 settlers. And those who are still left in Gaza, the Palestinians, are basically in a detention center. There's no other way to put it. They can't move around. They can't come in. They can't leave, and there's no economy.
What did you experience with that directly?
Sure. Again, I didn't visit Gaza, but along the West Bank, we visited a number of checkpoints, and we got to see the wall and several detention centers as well. The thing that I learned about the occupation. As you can talk about it in terms of deaths and ratios of Israeli deaths to Palestinian deaths, but that's not really, in my view, what the occupation is truly about. I mean, in some ways it's even more sinister or more disturbing, although death certainly obviously is that as well. But when you look at a planned subjugation of a group of human beings that involves daily humiliations, lack of context, and lack of control on the part of Palestinians to have any sort of self-determination. And when you see that in the faces of Palestinians, and you see it day after day after day, and I spoke with one woman in Hebron about, you know, what is the worst thing about the occupation? And she says the way it's destroying our culture. You've got Palestinians say in Abu Dis, which is right on the edge of Jerusalem. The wall goes right through the Palestinian town of Abu Dis. So you have families and friends on both sides of the wall who can no longer get to one another without a great deal of struggle and time and energy and that kind of thing. And even then, you can't always meet with one another. And the way that a 10-minute trip to work in Jerusalem now takes Palestinians who live in Abu Dis 2 hours, and so they can't stay there anymore. And you never know. That's the thing, is that you'll get to a checkpoint one day and the 18-year-old Israeli border guard will let you through one day, but the next day he won't, because he can. You know, it's that kind of randomness that I'm not sure we really understand in this country. I think that we are so privileged in this country to have some sort of legal system that's founded and predictable in a way that the Palestinians just have no knowledge of. And it's closing them down. For instance, it's 10 miles from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, and people who live in Bethlehem simply don't travel. And that's what it does, and it shuts down human spirits, I think, as much as anything. And certainly people are resisting nonviolently. We we met with many different groups, 6 or 7 or 8 different groups of folks everywhere from Hebron to Bethlehem to Jerusalem that are all involved in nonviolent resistance to the occupation, both Palestinian Arab and Israeli, because this isn't just the Palestinians who are resisting it. There are many, many Israelis who also resist the occupation. So, and just sort of circling back around again, it's this destruction of a culture that we're seeing there, and it's happening more slowly in some places and more quickly in others. But we're looking at having a 450-mile-long wall finished in the next 10 months. That's what Olmert has said. So, you know, what that will mean once that's finished is anybody's guess.
Who's Omer?
The Prime Minister.
What would you guess? You know, clearly there's an armed resistance and a nonviolent resistance happening among the Palestinians, just like there's the Kurds in Iran are doing there's a nonviolent campaign going on right now, sort of in the context of an armed group. Do you have any sense of where the balance of sentiment is among the Palestinian people as far as supporting these groups? And are these two different factions working cooperatively at all?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're working cooperatively per se. I wouldn't even say that armed resistance, if you're talking about martyrs or terrorists, I wouldn't even say that they're working cooperatively, be it the Al-Aqsa Brigade, which is a terrorist arm of Fatah or of Hamas. I think to a large extent, people are doing their own thing. Similar, actually, I think, to what's probably happening in Iraq. I don't think things are nearly as coordinated among those who are resisting there as people might want us to believe here in this country. So, I think most people want peace, and most people want justice. And many, many Palestinians are so very tired of the occupation. They just want the occupation to end. That's what we kept hearing over and over and over again. We just want the occupation to end. And I would argue that what you're calling armed resistance or suicide bombings, those are symptoms of the occupation.
While there are certainly groups among Palestinian society who feel the need to strike violently, even if it's only symbolically, given the obvious dominance of the Israeli military, it doesn't seem like there's a path forward with that exactly. What is the path forward for the nonviolent resistance to bring about some sort of peace with justice in the region?
It's a wonderful question. A lot's happening in a little town named Belin, which is a town we spent 2 days at and spent one night there as well. And there's a lot of resistance in Belin because the wall, which at that point is a fence, it's actually 3 fences, cuts right through the town of Belin and separates the villagers from their farmland. And so they've actually been cutting through the fence and making sure that the fence stays open. And then on their property on the other side of the fence, they actually built a little house, which is staffed 24/7 by members of the International Solidarity Movement and by villagers of Belin, because if they leave it, the Israeli Defense Forces or the IDF will come in and destroy it. There's no doubt in their minds about that. But they've taken it to court, this particular town, and this particular nonviolent resistance movement in this town has caught the imagination, I think, of several international groups, and they've gotten legal representation. And right now it's pending in the Israeli courts about the legality of this house that's built on the other side of the fence. But until that is resolved, the fence stays open, so people can move back and forth across the fence at this time. And that's just one example. I think what really has to happen is there has to be international pressure to end the occupation, both on the part of the United States and on the part of Europe. There's no doubt in my mind that, and I don't think there's any real doubt on the part of the minds of Israelis or Palestinians, that there has to be involvement by the larger international community if this occupation is going to stop.
So they've come up with ways of making some holes in walls here and there and resisting it. The strategy you're describing perhaps is one of diplomatic and political pressure upon Israel.
I think that's definitely what folks like to see. There's been a lot of energy around divestment campaigns. We spoke with a number of folks, including Jeff Halper, who is head of ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions. That's what he encourages, that kind of pressure, threats of divestment or actual divestment from Israel as being one possible way to get some leverage and some traction around ending the occupation. But given the imbalance of power that you alluded to earlier in the interview, there is simply no way that Palestine on its own can end the occupation. The power differential is just simply too great. And Palestine, even though Palestine is predominantly Arab and is surrounded by Arab neighbors, doesn't receive a lot of help from its Arab neighbors. I think there's a lot less pan-Arab nationalism going on than people in the West are led to believe. I think in terms of the way many Middle Eastern governments are thinking, is they're looking out for their own economic interests. And if those run in conflict, and as in the case of Jordan, with justice for Palestine, they're going to choose their own economic interests. We see this clearly in countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Iraq under Saddam Hussein was slightly more accommodating, but I don't know if it was really to a significant degree.
You said earlier that the Palestinian economy is entirely tied in with the Israeli economy. How is it possible to divest from Israel without hurting the Palestinians?
That's a good question. I think, you know, I really can't say definitively. I don't know how large Israel's GNP is, and I don't know what kind of fraction the Palestinian GDP is as a function of Israel's GDP. I do know that in terms of the dependency of economies, I think 80% of Palestine's economy is dependent on that of Israel. So, you know, there are no serious divestment campaigns, and if there were, yes, it's likely that there might be some at least short-term impact on Palestine. But things are so dire there now that I could see a way to start a campaign in which there's a divestment from Israel as long as the occupation continues, while at the same time giving direct aid to Palestinian organizations, not necessarily Hamas, but directly to Palestinians through, for instance, the Palestinian Children's Welfare Fund. Peace Action has a working group called Palestinian Education Network that sells products, and the proceeds go directly to Palestine. But I would also say, you know, I'm not sure that money's going to actually get there, because it goes through a number of Israeli checks, and many, many things get lost on their way to Palestine.
So what can listeners do to help change the situation in the area?
I think absolutely the first thing is to educate yourself and then start educating other people about what's happening in Israel and in Palestine. I'm sure that most of the listeners are aware of a report that was released by two Harvard scholars in March of this year around the power of the Israeli lobby in this country. And I would argue that the lobby of arms dealers and Christian Zionists are just as strong, or if not stronger, than that of any Jewish lobby in this country with respect to Israel. And I think that definitely plays itself out in the media in terms of what kind of information gets released and what doesn't. For instance, when we were there was a suicide bombing at a settlement in the West Bank, and three Israelis were killed. It was reported widely. The day we got back, there was a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv. You may remember that 9 Israelis were killed. I believe it was April 6th. It may have been April 8th. It may have been 2 days after we returned. And so in that span, 12 Israelis were killed, and that was widely reported in the international press. The same span of time, 28 Palestinians were killed by IDF forces, and not one of those deaths was reported in the international press. I think it's just important to educate. There are so many wonderful websites out there and organizations out there. There's End the Occupation. There's Bitter Fruits, which is a wonderful website because it's bitterlemon.org. the fascinating thing about this website is it gives both an Israeli and Palestinian perspective on the occupation, which is so important to hear both sides and to keep in dialogue with both sides, because you say, what can we do? I think that it won't be the Palestinian way or the Israeli way. It has to be a third way, and it has to be a creative, nonviolent way that I think we're still finding our way to. I don't think we've found that yet. And I think when we're talking with friends and neighbors about the occupation and thinking about it ourselves, I think we really need to remember that the positions are so calcified at this point. It's really such an interesting issue, and the histories are so different. Whether you think of the Jewish history or the Palestinian history of the region, they're so different. The vocabularies are so different. And I think we need to be constantly making the effort to bridge those vocabularies and bridge those histories and find common ground in order to find a way forward. But I think it's also going to require a letting go, both on the part of Israelis and Palestinians, to find a new way.
Now, earlier you mentioned the reference to wipe Israel off the map. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, said, I recently also wrote a column asking, does Israel have the right to exist? And I wonder, do you think Israel has a right to exist, politically speaking? And I wonder if the president of Iran also was referring to ending the state of Israel, not necessarily destroying it militarily. It's always been taken in the corporate media to say that Iran wants to kill them all. But there's actually more to the story. Of course, Israel founded in 1948 by the British mandate. So what do you think about that?
By UN resolution. Yeah, you know, it's not a question I even ask, to tell you the truth. It's like asking, does the United States have the right to exist? I mean, I think, you know, does it or does it not? I think I'm assumptive about the fact that it exists. Just the way I think many Palestinians are assumptive about Israel at this point. So I guess it's just not a question that I think really frames the debate or the problem or the challenge very well, because I think the assumption is there that it does exist. The reality is there that it does exist. And that comment that you alluded to by the Iranian president, you know, well, a couple of things about that. You know, you hear those kinds of comments. Hamas has talked about pushing Israel into the sea. That's rhetoric. And I think we have to understand that that's rhetoric, because while you have some of these groups saying these kinds of things, the reality is that the Israeli government is doing it. Israel is actually destroying Palestine through the occupation, and it's destroying itself, because there's no way for Israel to maintain the occupation in the long term. At this point, the Israeli government really lacks so much creativity about what to do, and that they're just managing the occupation. And in terms of your comments about Ahmadinejad, you know, I think that it's so much more complex, because there really is, like, there'd be no way to do it. There are so many Arabs living in Israel. There are Palestinians right there. It's a tiny, tiny place. So anytime you start talking about wiping Israel off the map, it's existential. There's no physicality to it. And it's foolish. I think it's foolish to take such remarks seriously, because A, there's no way to do it, and B, it's not as if you have all the Israeli Jews in one place. There's so many people in Israel and Palestine. You've got Jews, you've got Christians, you've got Muslims, and everybody's there together. So, you know, the reality is just so much different. There isn't this absolutely distinct thing called Israel that only has Israeli Jews. You know, as much as I think Israel would like that to be the case, it's not. And there's no getting around the fact that people are connected and people are related.
Well, we're really running out of time here, but is there anything else that people can do to get involved? We can support the Palestinian economy, we can educate ourselves, perhaps we can get involved in the Palestine Education Network. Anything else?
I think those are all great places to start. I would also recommend not buying products that are made in Israel. Start your own local boycott.
All right. Well, thank you, Ann Miller, Director of New Hampshire Peace Action, for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Making Waves Radio. We now bring you, from Red Eye Co-op Radio, excerpts from Three Wishes, Palestinian and Israeli Children Speak.
Three Wishes, written by award-winning Ontario author Deborah Ellis, presents the voices of Palestinian and Jewish Israeli children, age 8 to 18. They provide personal, brief, and realistic accounts of their daily life. Here are a few excerpts from what these children tell us.
Gull, age 12. My mother doesn't want me being rough and mean to people when I'm a soldier. She says she brought us up to be kind to people. She thinks going into the army will change the kind of person I am. I don't see how that can happen. I am who I am. How can anything change that? It's always there, the army, when I think of the future. All boys have to go into the army. It's the law. It's dangerous for Jews in a lot of places. The Palestinians are not the only people in the world who hate Jews. My mother has a friend in Montreal, in Canada, who has told her stories about people hating Jews there. People have always hated Jews everywhere, not just Germans and not just Palestinians.
Mona, age 11. I am a Palestinian. That is what I am. How could I be anything else? I wouldn't want to be from anywhere other than Palestine, but I wish life here were easier. I know life is easier for kids in other places, and I wish it were easier for us, just for a little while. I get tired of all the troubles. There never seems to be an end to them. Soldiers scare me more than anything else. Guns and soldiers. You don't have to be a bad person to get shot by them. Mostly it is good people who get shot. You should have to do something bad to get shot, but here everybody gets shot. The fighting is between the innocent Palestinians who have nothing and the Israelis who have everything. I wish all the Israelis would leave my country. I don't know any Israeli children, and I don't want to, because they have the same beliefs as their parents. They believe that I am not as good as they are. They are not the same as me. I don't know exactly how they're different from me, but they are.
Elisheva, age 18. Regarding the war with the Palestinians, I've gotten stronger in my belief that we are right. If the Palestinians were right, they wouldn't be so sneaky, so full of tricks. I feel a lot of anger towards the Palestinians. I can't feel real hate because it's hard for me to find bad things in people, but I still feel anger. When I walk through the old city of Jerusalem and see the Arabs there, I don't want to see them. I don't want them to be there. They make me angry.
Yanal, age 14. Israeli soldiers occupied our school last spring. We were under curfew when they came, so the school was empty, but they barged in anyway. They made holes in the doors, broke windows and furniture. They smashed everything. They wrote rude things on the blackboards. They even peed on the floors. And they call us animals. We all worked together to clean it up. It took us 3 days. It made me angry, but it made me feel strong, too, that we can fix whatever the Israelis try to do to us.
Yabane, age 18. Two of my friends were killed by Palestinians. One was shot. One was killed by a bomb. Neither were in the army. They were just kids, 17 years old. They weren't hurting anybody. They should not have died. I grew up with them. We were all together all through school. Our settlement is small, only 200 families. Everybody knows everybody. We used to do all kinds of things together. We went hiking, played sports, watched movies. They were killed just a couple of weeks ago, very close to each other. I feel sad all the time. Their deaths make me think more about the meaning of life in general, and meaning of life in Israel in particular. Why am I in Israel? Is this the place for me? Is there another place? No, there isn't. This is the place where I'm supposed to be, but it's not easy to see why.
Hassan, age 18. The thing I enjoy most is hanging out with my friends. We play cards and other games I can play with my hands. The thing that scares me the most is soldiers, because of the weapons they carry. They don't like us. All they want to do is shoot at us and kill us. I wish they would go away. I'd like to be a policeman when I get older. I'd be a good policeman. People would trust me and I would keep them safe. If I had three wishes, I would walk again. I would play soccer and I would go see beautiful places.
Asif, age 15. I understand the suicide bombers. They do what they do because of the Israeli occupation of their land. It isn't hard to understand. We Jews did violence against the British when they controlled Israel. We killed people and blew things up on our fight for freedom. Our soldiers kill and terrorize Palestinians, and things keep getting worse, not better. It's hard to say let's make peace to your enemy. It's easier for them to kill themselves and take some Israelis with them.
Salam, age 12. I shared a bedroom with Ayat. She was tidy, like me. One of my sisters is not tidy, and I'm glad I don't have to share with her. Ayat and I got along as normal children do. Sometimes we'd fight. Once she wore my shoes without asking first. That made me angry. She spent a lot of time studying. She was better at school than I am. She always told me I should study more, but I never saw the point. I was right. Studying didn't do Ayat any good. She didn't tell me she was going to do this. She should have told me. I would have kept her secret if she wanted me to. I would have liked to talk to her about it, maybe make her a special breakfast or do something special for her that day. She should have told me. She didn't tell any of us. She was almost finished school and was about to be married, and she kept planning those things as if everything was normal. Her fiancé is here a lot now. He's sad all the time. I don't think it would hurt if I blew myself up. I don't think it hurt my sister. I think she was very brave, not scared at all. I think she was probably very happy. I don't know if the girl she killed had a sister my age or not. What does it matter? I don't know any Israeli kids. Why would I want to?
Artov, age 15. I've been in Israel only 3 months. I'm from Russia. I miss Russia very much, even though Israel is very beautiful. I know a little bit about the Palestinians from the news. It seems that they all hate us, but I don't know why. I have not met any yet. It is impossible for us to meet. We are separate people.
Nora, age 12. I am from Beit Safafa to the south of Jerusalem in Palestine territory. I am a Palestinian. I was born with something wrong with my legs. I've always been in a wheelchair. I get around in the chair just fine. The wheels are like my legs. The soldiers are always around, but sometimes they move into the streets, and then everybody runs to get out of their way. If they feel like shooting, they'll just go ahead and shoot. They don't care if they shoot at a child or an older person. My mother is afraid that they'll shoot at me for not getting out of their way fast enough. I think I could throw stones like the other children and still get away very quickly, but I can't throw stones if I'm with my mother. I know there are other children in the world who suffer a lot. They get shot at even more than we do, and they get sick and go hungry. Someday I'd like to do something to help them. If I had 3 wishes, I would become a doctor, and I would be famous, maybe as a writer, and I would be able to walk.
Those were excerpts from The Voices of Children, recorded in the book 3 Wishes, Palestinian and Israeli Children Speak, collected by Deborah Ellis and published by Douglas and McIntyre. For more on the Canadian Jewish Congress campaign to suppress the book, check the Red Eye website at coopradio.org/redeye.
In the hills of Ayalon, above the broken earth, 2 boys shout and play with a ball on a field of shrub and dirt. Divided sons of Abraham, exhausted embrace, Prince of Islam, Pride of Judah, know each other's face. If we met on the sands of Sinai under a molten sky, and if you held me in your sights and looked me in the eye, what would you do? If we met on the sands of Sinai under a molten sky, and if I held you in my sights and looked you in the eye, shoot you dead. In the hills of Ayalon, once were no man's land, shepherds chase their wandering sheep and lead them home again. My grandfather died at Dachau, never will I forget. The British set fire to my grandfather's village, left 12 miles long dead. If we met on the cliffs of Arabon, stunned by the rocket's flash, and if you found my heart exposed and a pistol in your grasp, what would you do? If we met on the cliffs of Arabon, stunned by the rocket's flash, and if I found your heart exposed and a pistol in my grasp, I would take you prisoner, hide you away, then set you free.
in the hills of Iowa. Young ones play a game, toss an orange in the air and call each other's name. Ricky, Shimon, Shalom, Naomi, who catch it before it falls. Yusuf, Hassan, Amal, Amira, tear down the wall. If we met by the river Jordan under a rain of nails, and if you raised your rifle up and your aim could not fail, what would you do? If we met by the river Jordan under a rain of nails, and if I raised my rifle up and my aim could not fail, I would put down my gun, open my heart, and
that was Fred Small with The Hills of Ilon.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information. 430-9722.